Welcome to Giving an Answer, the show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. I am your host, H.C. Felder, and today the topic is responding to arguments against intelligent design. And to talk with me about this, I have J.T. Bridges. Let me tell you about J.T. He has a bachelor's from Ohio State University, a master's of divinity from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. He has a master's in philosophy from Baylor University, and he is currently finishing his philosophy of religion at Southern Evangelical Seminary, where he is also a professor. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Earl.
Glad to have you. Interesting topic. And just to let our audience know that you are serious on this topic, that you are a bona fide person who knows about it. You are finishing up your PhD, and what's the title of your dissertation?
The title of my dissertation is an evaluation of the intelligent design neo-Darwinism controversy based on an eclectic philosophy of science rooted in Thomistic realism.
Okay. Now, you may not know what that means, audience, but that's some heavy stuff. Yeah. That's some deep stuff.
Hopefully I know what that means.
Okay. Yeah. So, well, let's get started. Now, we're talking about responding to arguments against intelligent design, but let's set the groundwork. Exactly what is intelligent design?
Well, intelligent design actually, it's a phrase that has taken on a very, very specific meaning in recent years, but design arguments range over different areas of science. Now, when I talk on the topic of science and Christianity, there are three main places that science and Christianity might conflict, and they're the different areas of origin. So the origin of the universe, or cosmology, the origin of life on our planet, and then our planet's specific life-sustaining potential, and that's the field of astrobiology. So cosmology, astrobiology, and then evolution biology or origin of life studies, things like that. So those are the three areas that science and Christianity potentially conflict, and it's the areas where we're finding that design arguments are coming on stronger and stronger in cosmology, astrobiology, and intelligent design science, as it's known, as sort of a counterposition to the neo-Darwinian view of life.
What's the conclusion of the intelligent design theory?
Well, in intelligent design, whether you're talking about cosmology or astrobiology or the nature of information in things like DNA, all of them take on a similar form in that they look at the fine tuning of initial conditions in the universe. They look at the fine tuning of the conditions necessary for complex life on planet Earth, or they look at the complex specified information in something like DNA, and they make probabilistic arguments such that neither chance nor necessity are good explanations, right? So Bill Dembski, William A. Dembski, whose 1998 book, The Design Inference, he's a mathematician who does work in probability theory and information, mathematical information. And the subtitle of the book is Eliminating Chance Through Small Probabilities. And so what he develops is a rigorous mathematical, formally mathematical argument to say that whenever chance is offered as an explanation, that all of these coincidences or convergences of highly improbable things, that chance is an answer, well, there's a there's a field of study that studies chance. It's probability theory, right? Instead of just our intuitions, it gives a formal representation of what those chances are. And what we find in all these different areas is that some vague intuitional reference to chance is simply not sufficient, because the probabilities themselves are so small, they're so vanishingly small, that in many cases chance simply is not a sufficient explanation. So design becomes more probable so that there's an immaterial mind orchestrating the construction of the universe, orchestrating the design of our planet, orchestrating the nature of life, become much more tenable as philosophical or even scientific conclusions.
Okay, so we're going to now jump into the arguments against intelligent design, mm-hmm. and one of them is very similar to what you were just talking about, mm-hmm. and that is the fact that the Anthropic principle. And right. For those who don't know, the Anthropic principle is that it looks like the universe was finely tuned for life here on Earth. Mm-hmm. That if certain variables were changed just slightly, there would be no life.
Right,
and the odds against that happening by chance are astronomical.
Right.
Now, what some of the proponents or some of the those who are against intelligent design would say, well, the Anthropic principle is basically false. Mm-hmm. The universe is not fine-tuned. And to quote a scientist, the universe is not fine-tuned for humanity. Humanity is fine-tuned to the universe.
Yeah.
What's your response to that?
That seems like a strange comment coming from somebody who is scientifically knowledgeable. First of all, it's because obviously the beginning of the universe happened before humans arose in the universe. Whether you take a young Earth or an old Earth creationist model, or whether you adhere to the Big Bang cosmology or not, the universe exists before humans exist. So whatever happens in the fine tuning of the universe, that happens prior to the existence of humanity. So humanity can't be fine tuned to the universe because the universe is prior. So the structural elements, those are all prior to the existence of humans. But I think the gist of what the guy is pointing at, what the scientist is getting at, is that there are many people who say, like somebody like Richard Dawkins will say, well, of course, humans arose in this universe because of all the elements that allow for complex life. Right. Because if those elements weren't in place, then we wouldn't be here to observe them.
Right.
So of course, complex conscious human beings arose in a universe that looks as if it was intended for them. But that's simply not the case. So that's the way the atheists will typically argue. But what we would like to point out is that there are certain things, like, for example, the entropy of the early universe. This is an initial condition. This is something that happens within the singularity itself, or it's a feature of the initial singularity from which the universe explodes into existence for 14 billion years ago or whatever. And entropy is a measure of the disorder of a system. So as systems become systems will tend toward more and more disorder, right? Naturally. So if I take an ice cube, it's very highly ordered, mm-hmm. something. If I put it on the table, it will take in heat from the surrounding air and it will begin to melt. Well, the puddle of water on the table is much more disordered than the ice cube itself, right? So natural systems left to themselves will tend toward more and more disorder, right? Now, what we find as an initial condition for the universe, for the Big Bang singularity, is that the level of entropy is extremely ordered. So the entropy is extremely low, and so, but it's extremely, extremely low. That is, it's 10.0 to the 10th to the 123rd, which is what Bruce Gordon, who's a Christian philosopher of physics, it's a hyper exponential. So it's 10 to the 10th to the 123rd orders of magnitude of organization. And Robert Spitzer, who's a PhD in physics and a Catholic priest, he explains that whether you take that this is the only known universe, or whether you take an oscillating model of the universe, he says that because entropy will always increase, right? He says that if you posit more universes that gave rise to our universe, the problem becomes compounded. Because if entropy increases, and it's extremely highly ordered to begin with, it had to be even more ordered in past theoretical states.
Right.
So so he says that you can't get around something like the initial condition of the fine-tuning of the initial condition of entropy.
And you already touched on it, but another explanation that scientists use, atheists use, mm-hmm. against the design of the universe is the fact that the multiple universe theory, which you mentioned.
Yeah.
So the theory is that there are maybe millions,
yeah.
or billions of universes with
right.
all these different constants that, you know, are tweet this way and that way. We just happen to live in the one universe that is tweet for our existence.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. And so there's a phrase called probabilistic resources. So the odds that our one known universe would have come into existence in the precise way that it did in the one time that we know of that universe is extremely unlikely. So how do we raise the probabilistic resources to pay back all of this probability that's against this chance hypothesis? Well, we posit an infinite number of universes, because after all, in an infinite number of universes, anything is possible, even highly, highly unlikely things, right? The problem is that if there are other universes, they are empirically undetectable. And yeah, so there's a quote from a Nobel laureate, Arno Penzias, who was a co-discoverer of the cosmic background radiation. And he says this, people are uncomfortable with the purposefully created world. To contradict purpose, people tend to speculate about things they haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
And so also Guillermo Gonzalez, who's an astrophysicist who taught at Iowa State University, he says, well, the multiverse is really a metaphysical construct that has philosophical implications on the initial conditions and the fine-tuning of the universe. But it's not a scientific idea, because science is based on what? It's things that are empirically detectable, right, obey natural laws that we're aware of.
Right.
The multiverse isn't anything like that.
Right.
It's simply a David Berlinski, who's an agnostic, quotes Christopher Isham as saying, look, Christopher Isham, who's an astrophysicist, looks at the way in which some of his atheist colleagues go to extreme lengths to support highly untenable scientific hypotheses simply because it gets around this sort of anthropic, theistic view of the universe.
Right. It's really interesting because when I read scientists and they talk about how irrational Christianity is, because you know they are based, their view is based on facts, empirical things that you can weigh, that you could touch, that you could feel. Yet this whole multiverse theory, there's absolutely no evidence for it. Like you said, there's no empirical evidence for it. You can't see it, you can't touch it, there's no way to know it. Mm-hmm. It's just a theory in order to get around the whole idea of a creator.
Yep.
It's philosophy. It's not science.
That's right. It's metaphysics.
That's
right.
Exactly what it is. Okay, so the next objection that we have is that, okay, this is just another God of the Gap fallacy. Mm-hmm. And this is the God of the Gap fallacy is the charge that every time we can't answer something or every time we can't figure something out, we call God to the rescue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, way back when the cavemen were walking around, they heard thunder. They said, oh, God did it.
Right.
But now we know God didn't do it. And so as time has gone on, science has eliminated God from most of these things. And, and now we've gotten to the creation of the universe, and science will get there. But in the meantime, we are positing God just like the cavemen. Caveman posited God for the thunder.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, there is a danger when we use empirical evidence to form probabilistic arguments as evidence for the existence of God. There's a danger there that when we tie these arguments to modern science, that we may be just simply positing God as a stopgap for an otherwise unknown natural explanation, which is what you just said. The God of the Gaps reasoning. Curiously, this doesn't work in at least two areas of intelligent design, cosmology and intelligent design science. And that is because when we're talking about cosmology, we're talking about everything that is. There isn't a gap left. We're talking about the entire the nature of the entire natural world coming into existence. So there isn't a gap between the phenomena and the explanation. We're trying to explain the entire coming to being of the known universe from an initial singularity. Dr. William Lane Craig is fairly famous for his work in the Kalam cosmological argument. He says it has two premises and a conclusion. Everything that begins to exist needs a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe needs a cause.
Right.
Now we're talking about the entirety of the natural realm. And so that cause that began the universe can itself be a natural cause.
Right.
Because then we have to have something that begins it, and it's an infinite regress. And so the cause of the initial singularity has to be, by definition, immaterial, because matter and space-time, that's what we're trying to explain. It has to be outside of space-time, so it has to be eternal, right? And the fine-tuning elements show us that it's most likely a mind rather than something mindless, right? Because only a mind puts all of these heterogeneous independent causes together to make one specific object, right?
Right.
So.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And also, I like to say that the God of the Gaps fallacy doesn't apply because we are actually looking at the effects and we are rationalizing a cause.
Right.
We are not just throwing out God. We are saying whenever we see X, Y, and Z, there is an intelligent design behind
it.
So we are not trying to explain something, just use God as a filling or gap filled method. We're saying no, intelligent is required because that is a scientific explanation when we see causes that
we're not trying to explain something we don't know.
Right.
We're trying to explain something we do know.
Right.
That
right.
doesn't have inherently a naturalistic explanation as a sufficient explanation.
Right.
So when we talk about, this is entirely Bill Dembski's point, when it comes to the information, the complex specified information found in proteins and genetics. He says you simply can't say chance or a combination of chance and law-like necessity from chemistry and physics. It simply doesn't give you the information that the actual type of mathematical information that we find at those levels of biology.
Right.
And so chance and design, chance and necessity are both eliminated as possible explanations. What you have left is design, which is what he calls his explanatory filter.
Right. Now the next one is the fact that computer programs can simulate the development of artificial life.
Yeah.
And a number of scientists have developed computer programs that already replicate how life was created, how cells multiply, and how they become more complex. So I guess the thinking is that if computers can simulate this in a naturalistic environment, then why need God?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, it's important that we run computer simulations as long as all the factors can be factored in. So I'm not against running computer simulations in order to gain some insight into natural phenomena. That's not the problem. The problem, there are a couple of these different programs that I'm aware of, EVE, EV, and Avita. Stephen C. Meyer in his book Signature in the Cell deals with the efficacy, the explanatory power that these programs might have. And because his area is the philosophy of science, he punts to an expert, Robert Marx III, who for a long time has worked on computational analyses and information. And what Robert Marx does, because he's a computer scientist professionally, and specifically in information theory, he says, no. When you look at these programs, the way in which the software has been engineered is such that after every trial run, those consequences that are closer to a target, an information target, are retained, and then the computer will simulate another run. This is why you can get something that looks like complex specified information after, say, 40 or 45 generations. It's because in the computer software programming, they have programmed the computer to run toward a target.
Right.
Well, naturalistic evolution says that everything that evolution does is completely blind. So you may have some adaptation that is gained in some evolutionary some mutational event. Well, that may be lost in the next generation. Why?
Right.
Because blind evolution can't say, oh, we need this piece so that in the next generation we can have another piece and fit these two pieces together. Only a mind does that. Blind evolution doesn't do that. And so you can't have computer simulations that have an underlying target that the computer is reaching for as a simulation of what evolutionary biologists are theorizing, because they're apples and oranges.
And I've also read that those computer simulations do not really mimic life or the conditions under which life actually came about.
Because
there, like you said, that some things die, you know, and that's not a consideration. It just assumes that everything is living and preserved and is going forward when that's not how it actually happens.
Yep.
So then here's the big one. Mm-hmm. Intelligent design is religiously motivated. It can't be science, because it's religiously motivated. It's talking about God. When you talk about God, you talk about supernatural. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about supernatural, you can't be talking about science.
Yeah. Well, then the multiverse isn't science either, because that's motivated by atheistic metaphysics. This objection is an interesting one, because it's completely irrelevant. If a scientist is a Muslim, say he's a theist because he's devoted to Islam, or he's Jewish, or he's Christian, or some other religion, and that religion motivates him to come up with and support empirically some particular theory. Science doesn't care where the theories come from. Science cares, and scientists care, whether they are empirically supported and rationally defended, right? And so, for example, in the history of chemistry, I don't remember the guy's name, but he had a sort of a dream vision of the benzene ring.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
The structure of the benzene ring.
Right.
And then he did all of his experiments, and he realized that the benzene ring has this octagonal shape. Well, because that theory ultimately arose out of some sort of mystical dream experience, doesn't make it less science.
Right.
Because the theory itself is empirically verifiable.
Right.
Right? And so when, if somebody who's a Christian theist like Bill Dembski and says, no, the information found at the smallest levels of life leads us to infer a designer, and he supports that, even if it's religiously motivated, if he supports that with a rigorous mathematical argument based on no free lunch theorems and the law of conservation of information, then his motivations are for beginning that project are irrelevant to the merit of the project itself.
Right. That is a fallacy.
Yeah.
I mean, like me saying...
The genetic fallacy.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. It looks at the source and it discounts it because of the source.
Right.
I mean, if I'm a Christian and I say 1 + 1 = 2, does that mean that it's not 2 because I'm a Christian?
Right.
I mean, truth is truth, regardless of the source.
Right. If Friedrich Nietzsche says something about atheistic existentialism in a syphilis-induced maniacal rage, it might be correct.
Right.
Even though it's done from an insane person.
Right.
Right. The source doesn't matter. Only reality matters.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, here's another argument against intelligent design.
Mm-hmm.
The design is flawed
and
could not be the result of an omniscient God. For instance, we have too many teeth to fit in our mouth, so that's why sometimes we have to have wisdom teeth removed.
Yeah.
The birth canal of a woman is too small for easy passage of a baby's head. And while the arms and legs used for different purposes and made from the same material, the design of the eye is flawed because of an inverted retina.
Right.
And the panda's thumb just doesn't seem to serve him well when it comes to bamboo.
Yeah, I think there are two mistakes in the objection itself. One of the mistakes is that it's called the argument from dysteleology, or the lack of good design. And first of all, intelligent design science doesn't stake its claims at the level of anatomical features like wisdom teeth or the birth canal or panda's thumbs. It stakes its claims at the level of molecular biology and the information-rich biomacromolecules that we find. And the probability theories that Bill Dembski has come up with. So that's the first mistake, is that the design that we're talking about are not things like wisdom teeth or the birth canal. The design that we're looking at in the theory of intelligent design is something on a much, much smaller scale. Okay. The second thing is that the designer couldn't be an omniscient God. Well, intelligent design science, as a science, posits intelligence as a generic feature. So it could be human intelligence, it could be some superhuman alien intelligence, it could be an angel, it could be God, right?
Okay.
It just treats intelligence as a generic source as opposed to chance or necessity. And the second thing is that after you've, these arguments are extremely, they're extremely selective. Okay, so our wisdom teeth come in, but what about all the other exquisitely precise functioning, say within a single cell, So the argument from dysteleology is very selective. It picks out things that it presumably sees as not designed. And finally, it introduces basically the God of Christianity, and it asks for a theological explanation. And one of the explanations that I'm toying with is an explanation from the problem of evil, and that is, why are humans not smarter or stronger or designed better? Well, look at all the human wickedness that we find with all of our physical limitations. What if we were stronger or smarter or faster?
That's
we probably
point.
Would have destroyed ourselves by now.
That's a very good point.
And the last thing is this, that in Genesis, God doesn't say it's perfect. What does he say? It's good.
Yeah.
So can human teeth grind up food? Yeah. The last time I checked, the world population is over 6 billion people. So apparently the narrowness of a woman's birth canal doesn't ultimately preclude human reproduction.
Right.
Human eyes, even though they're perhaps imperfect, they're good for seeing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the argument is it demands something like a perfect design when at least biblical Christianity says that God made things good. Never says he makes things perfect.
Actually, I've read something where it was talking about the eye, and the fact that it's inverted actually helps us. I can't remember exactly what the reasoning was, but there was a reason. And sometimes we may not completely understand the design.
Yes.
And that doesn't mean that there wasn't a designer.
Right.
I mean, if I look at a car, and if it's not a great-looking car, that doesn't mean it wasn't designed.
Right. It assumes that you know comprehensively everything that should be in the car.
Right.
And that this piece is extra. Well, all the things that they called vestigial organs that they're now finding uses for.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
This is
exactly.
The same point.
Okay. Well, we got about a minute on this last one. And this is the argument that there is no such thing as objective design. We just look at something and our mind basically forces design on something. It's not there objectively.
Yeah. Well, this is the power of the intelligent design argument, and that is that it takes out intuitions of design. Like, well, you know, you look at that cup, the cup seems to be designed for a purpose. It takes all those out. Those are based on informal intuitions. Dembski's arguments are based on formal mathematical evaluations of information.
Right.
Based on probability theory.
Right.
So it takes all of these intuitions, qualitative arguments, and it makes precise quantitative claims based on mathematical information. So the fact that design is not detectable, it simply misrepresents what ID science is.
Okay, well, JT Bridges, Professor Bridges, we have come to the end of the show. It just flew by.
Yeah.
And that will end this episode. Join us again next time. And until then, goodbye and God bless.
You can find out more about Giving an Answer, as well as listen to other episodes by visiting us online at www.givinganswer.org.